And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host and president here at the Center for International Maritime Security, Matthew Hipple. So a great friend of SIMSEC, Benjamin Armstrong, wrote an article for the Armed Forces Journal called Unmanned Naval Warfare, Retrospect and Prospect. And it was a fantastic article. I recommend you read it. But it was about a curious project called the QH-50-. BJ's intention was to show how drones were far older than we thought. Some may have heard of the Coastal Battleship No. 4, which was a pre-First World War battleship that was turned into a radio-controlled target. So while we think of unmanned aircraft and unmanned vessels as relatively new projects and concepts, they in fact are not. As a treat today, we've reached back to Peter Papadakos, who is the son of the inventor of the QH-50 and the man who carries on that heritage today, and as well as some very good work in preserving a lot of naval and military history, ordnance, weapon systems, and making those up and ready for museum exhibits. But he is here today to talk to us about the history of the QH-50 program. His father, the team that designed the project, and the different ways that it was used in Vietnam. And this will be the first of two podcasts. The second will actually look more into the modern age of the QH-50 program, because while it was abandoned as an anti-submarine weapon, the Navy kept its hands in the pot, and later the Army, to use it in more modern battlefields. But before we get further into that, let's take a quick pause to get a word from my wife.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we are back with Peter Papadakos, who is the I'll just turn it over to you. You know, I gave you the brief beforehand. This is a minute or two to tell people, so I don't know what title to use. You're a man about town, a man of history, and an engineer. So you're a man of many things. So I'll let you tell our listeners who you are and what you're about and where you came from.
Well, in my beginning with the company that my father founded in 1946, he founded it. He called the Jardine Company of America, and out of New York State. And his hopes and dreams were to be a helicopter manufacturer. And he thought that would really get a big boost by buying the assets of the bankrupt Bendix helicopter system, or Bendix helicopter company, upon Walter Bendix's death. By 1946, those assets were available for purchase, which was a couple of coaxial, very large helicopters with radial engines. But they had problems with directional control because they were trying to use a form of a differential collective, meaning increase the lift on the lower set to turn the aircraft, destabilize the rotor system. So dear old dad, with the help of a good friend, bought the assets, and by 1949, the New Jardine company was working out of Maurice Fields over in Long Island, and they were trying to get an Air Force contract so they could demonstrate this coaxial system. Well, in short order, the Marine Corps sees this, and they're wondering if this thing can be downsized. And so by 1954, 1955, Jardine is doing their first flights of what they would call the rotor cycle. And even then, Jardine began to butt heads with a very feudal Marine Corps, because you could, by at least what our chief test pilot claimed, you could take an enlisted man and within 4 hours of instruction show this person, this new pilot, how to fly one of our rotor cycles solo. The helicopter was so easy to fly. And in those days, you needed to have a 2-year associate's degree to be a Marine Corps pilot. And so instead of it calling it a helicopter, my father told the Marines, well, this is more like a motorcycle, and so we're going to call it a rotor cycle. And that sort of lasted about a year until the Marine aviation elites came and said, you know what, this is not going to fly. You're not going to take uneducated enlisted personnel and put them up in the air. And so, you know, around this period, Chief of Naval Operations, CNO Arleigh Burke, Admiral Arleigh Burke.
So wait, no, Peter, yes. Before we get into the 1960s, which is where the DASH program starts, who are you?
I'm sorry.
We got to start. Let's skip ahead to the part where you show up in the picture here. And so
I entered the picture in 1972. I'm 10 years of age, and Jardine has just gone through its big layoff, because in 1966, the Secretary of Defense had cut all of the funding to the DASH program because of the rising costs of the air war in Vietnam. But SecDef McNamara was known as a slide rule kind of guy, and he did this analysis of the QH-50 program, and he said, you know what, we're losing too many QH-50s in a time of relative peace out in the Atlantic, and he used that as justification to scale the program back. And so Jardine had its big layoff. We went from 550 personnel at St. James, Long Island, New York, to literally down to 16. And so, you know, I was with my dad at that point, you know, with him during the summer, and he asked me one day if I wouldn't mind working in the parts department. And I thought, this is going to be fantastic. This is going to be great. And I showed up, and I'm the only one there. And at 10 years of age, I was given a list of parts, and because we still had QH-50s that were still being flown, not only, you know, there were still some Navy commands that were still using them, but we also had the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. They were flying QH-50s off 6 Japanese ships. We also had the U.S. Army that was still flying QH-50s at Pueblo, Colorado, and at White Sands Missile Range. And so I part supported them, and that's what my function was. And you know, I would go through our 100,000 square foot parts building, and I would pull parts all day, and I would bring them to another man, and then he would prep them for shipping. And that was my function. And so that's when I started with the QH-50. It was always a family affair, and I eventually, you know, as I got older, you know, went away to college, came back, and then I was hired back at Jardine to be the program manager at a time when QH-50 had a resurgence in, it wasn't a resurgence in capability, but the capability was rediscovered by Israel and by Germany. And both wanted to take modern avionics, put them on the QH-50, and see how it would work. And I was the program manager for both programs, and both programs were successes, but they never got further funded beyond their development and test stage. It was, though, a validation of my father's, because my father, again, he built the aircraft. He did not build the electronics that went on the QH-50, and that is a big distinction, because the electronics that controlled our drone helicopter were from the 40s. And, you know, one of the big linchpins or failures in the whole program was the fact from the very time that the QH-50 was deployed on U.S. naval ships from 1962 all the way to the point where it finally did its last flight in 2006, it continued to fly with the same vacuum tube command and control system that it was first deployed with. It was never upgraded by anyone.
Yeah. That's pretty wild.
And so when people ask me today, you know, well, what do you think the QH-50 could do? I say it's all a function of the command and control, because the airframe has not changed. You know, the laws of Bernoulli's equations and everything else that goes with, you know, airflow over the rotors, those things have not changed. Yes, the engines may have gotten a little bit lighter. Maybe, you know, if you took the new Rolls engine, for example, and put it on the QH-50, but, you know, there's over 350 pounds of wiring and old command and control that's on that aircraft, and it would boost our payload on that 20-foot rotor system probably up to 2,000 pounds.
So let's go back. Let's go back then.
Sure.
So you are indeed not only the son of your father, but the son of this program, as is very clear from
the
age of 10.
I'm the last surviving. I call myself the last Dash Man, even though there are other. We stay in contact on a daily basis with other Dash personnel, because I still have the surviving aircraft in a hangar building that is just north of Reno. We still have them. Currently, I think we have six in our building. Two are completely restored. One is currently undergoing restoration, and the others will eventually get completely restored. You know, it was my hope that if we kept some flight assets available, that at some point, you know, there would be this interest to maybe see what could happen again with them. But the problem is that there's a risk averseness that's out there on larger platforms, and you know, you can sort of see it with, you know, the K-MAX helicopter that's flying around. There's only one of them, and the Marine Corps doesn't seem to want to put any money behind building anymore. Northrop Grumman's got the Navy all tied up with Fire Scout now on its third design iteration. And I'd have to think about going back as to how long. Well, I guess it's been going. That's been going on now for 17 years, and they keep trying to figure out, you know, what is the best, you know, rotor system to go with Northrop Grumman's electronics, because that's what Northrop Grumman does. They don't build the aircraft. They're looking for an aircraft to fly their electronics. And whereas when we were building the QH-50, we did it completely the other way around.
So let's take a step back.
Sure.
So now we know who you are. So let's go back to 1960. So where we left off was we have Arleigh Burke, we have an increasing interest in the Navy in unmanned systems, kind of like we have today. We have a unique coaxial rotor system, which means the two rotors on top of one another, for those who are unfamiliar with it. So what was the intent? So some people may have read BJ's article.
Sure.
And some people, I gave a little hint to it in my introduction talking about anti-submarine warfare. But why don't you describe, what was the Navy looking to do with it? And then we'll kind of move on and say kind of how that evolved as it moved on into the fleet and then started getting kind of worked on and modified and innovated as forces in Vietnam started to use them. But go ahead.
Sure. Well, you know, there was a scare that was occurring as a function of what the Navy detected and what the intelligence service detected as an increase in the building of Soviet submarines. And the problem was is that in World War II, the only way that you could effectively prosecute a submarine target was that it essentially put the destroyer or any other ship that was prosecuting a submarine target virtually on top of the submarine. You had to have a sonar contact, and then you essentially charged at the target. You would launch either Hedgehog, which was a thrown forward type depth charge, or the ship would pass over it, lose contact in the process, and then roll off a couple of depth charges, hoping to score a hit. You know, it put the ship almost in immediate danger. You couldn't prosecute a Soviet submarine that way. And so the Navy's idea was that if you could take one of our manned rotor cycles and scale it up a little bit and put off the shelf 1940s era command and control equipment on that aircraft and make it into a drone, you could then prosecute a target up to 12 miles away. And because while sonar technology was increasing as a function of the advancements in technology and detection ranges, the ability to prosecute that target did not. And so this is what the big push was to use this drone helicopter to do. Arleigh Burke had over 240 of these World War II era destroyers that had no weapon systems capability to prosecute that kind of a target. So he came out with the Fleet Rehabilitation and Modernization Program in the 1960s, early 1960s. And he wanted to make the drone anti-submarine helicopter known as Dash and the anti-submarine rocket ASROC. And he wanted to put those two systems on his World War II era destroyers to prosecute that Russian submarine threat. And ASROC was designed to prosecute from 1 to 3 mile at that time, and Dash was going to go from 3 mile to 22 mile, assuming that, you know, you had different wave heights and whatnot, but you know, and you were flying the aircraft no more than 1,000 feet high and taking into considerations of the curvature of the Earth, because the aircraft was flown line of sight. And so that is what the purpose was of the Dash program. We also were trying to couple the helicopter to the new and emerging Honeywell-developed Mark 44 homing torpedo. And so there were all of these technologies that were all coming together. The SQS-23 sonar system, which had those advanced detection capabilities, and also, though, at the same time, if we took the command and control system off the shelf, meaning it had already been developed for, I believe it was the F-9F Cougar drone being flown over at China Lake, they were going to take all of that equipment and put it on the drone helicopter so that it could be deployed a whole lot quicker than trying to develop something and then, of course, and then having that long lead time to get it out to the fleet. So there was this rush. They call it telescoping. And so what they did is that they took a development program that they figured would take 10 years to get to the fleet, and they took it down to 3 years. And it did work. But the problem was, of course, is that Arleigh Burke, who retired then in 1961 after being a three-term CNO overseeing this complete, you know, revolution, when he retired, he essentially retired and gave the CNO's job to an aviator. And the aviation community did not like this new emerging technology because they saw it as a threat to, you know, their jobs and to their community. It was a destabilizing technology, an innovative technology, and the community that it was being introduced to, which was the surface Navy, just was not prepared for it at all. And so, that is because we need to understand what the thinking was in those days, you know, and also we didn't have the oversight that we did post-Vietnam that existed at that time. So the Navy also, to a certain extent, had an ability to get a new technology out into the fleet and then try to fix it while it was deployed, you know, during those operational days to get greater reliability out of it, essentially using the fleet as the test article and to try to fix any kind of problems that might come up. And so this is the flexibility, this was the idea and the intent behind the drone anti-submarine helicopter. And so there was this incredible there was this incredible need that was put on Jaredyne that they had to produce this vehicle, and when all of the electronics companies couldn't agree on how they were going to integrate it, the CNO asked Jaredyne to be program manager for the Dash weapon system, and my father agreed to do it. So he was the first and the only civilian program executive officer for the Dash weapon system, and he made all of the electronic companies either work with Jaredyne, or we would take their product, for example, like the decoder, we would take that, we would buy it, and then we would have our people integrated into the automatic flight control system.
Let's talk about that control system. I want to emphasize to those who may have missed it when you said it, is this a line of sight control system? So to those that are used to the modern day concept of drones where everything is controlled by a camera, that's not happening with the Dash. This is something that somebody is standing on the deck and controlling and watching from far away. Maybe you can describe some of how that system worked, how people used it, just so people can understand, and maybe some of the challenges. You had described that the C2 system was so old and line of sight.
Well, to get into the mindset of what was going on here, you know, back when the QH-50, the very first QH-50, which is a C model, but in those before the standardized the Navy came out with a new numbering system later on, and that's what established the QH. But before that period, it was called the DSN-3. When the very first DSN-3s came out, the very first weapon fit was not Mark 44 or Mark 43 torpedoes. It was a Mark 57 nuclear depth bomb, 15 kiloton device. And you can see that on display today at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. That's the only place where an American citizen can go and see the original payload that was envisioned for the QH-50, and it's on display to this day. It's over in the Vietnam section at the Udvar-Hazy Center. But that was the original designed weapon system that was going to be used for the QH-50. The QH-50, therefore, was not designed to be a reusable aircraft. The first 289 QH-50s that were built as disposable drones. And this is key because the very last disposable drone, 289, that's the one that's on display at the Smithsonian. And so we were able to save the very last of the disposable drones. And you can tell what is a disposable drone because all of the wiring is exposed. It's not encased in a rubber bundle. It's not in any kind of a waterproof mechanism or any kind of Bendix connectors or anything like that. All the wiring is essentially, and it's all tied together with like this wax-like twine. It's an incredible thing. But that is what the first 289 DSN-3s, later the QH-50C, that is what they were designed to do. And then the Navy said, you know what, we've got the aircraft out in the fleet, and we're having problems with this lack of all-weather capability because now we're trying to reuse them. So now you've here is key. This is very key. You know, you're talking about people who are flying with what is called FPV, first person view, on a camera, and they're flying, you know, these drones, and people see the view when they're flying this drone. The QH-50 operator had none of that. All he saw was when he launched the aircraft, he had the visibility. This is why the left side or the port side is painted red and the right side is painted green. So that essentially when the aircraft took off, you as the drone controller could see what your aircraft was doing as a function of color representation.
That's great. I had no idea. I never thought of that. That's so brilliant. I was like, why are these such bespoke drones? Like, they look so good, but no, that's perfect. Anyways, I'm sorry. Continue.
And that's And again, when you go, and of course, you know, when you go to see the QH-50 at the Smithsonian, you know, make sure you see that, because one side is red and one side is green. So the very, very early fleet drones, and I'm talking the very low numbers, like there's only one that survives over at the Pima Air and Space Museum. It is painted all gray. And there's a couple we have left that way intentionally because they are such early serial numbered birds. But that, what drove that coloration was the drone controllers saying they couldn't tell what their aircraft was doing up there against the blue sky. And therefore, we came out with those high visibility colors. But see, when you launch that aircraft and you got it up there, essentially, the aircraft is now being tracked by the ship's radar. And in the Combat Information Center, there is a master plotting board. And we called it the bug. There was a bug that essentially was the identifier for the QH-50. And then there was the target. And then what you were going to do is that you were essentially going to make the QH-50 go in the direction of where the submarine contact is, and preferably get right on top of it before you drop your torpedoes. And essentially the QH-50 would go flying out, and you would set the altitude, you would transfer command to CIC, Combat Information Center, and then they would take over, and then all they're going to do is they had a heading knob, an altitude knob, and a speed knob. That was it. And so then they would just sit there, and they would wait for the two bugs essentially to converge. And then once you got close to it, you slowed your airspeed down, went into a hover, and you just dropped your torpedoes right there. Now, you, before you left, you would set one torpedo to, let's say, a search depth of 500 feet, set the other one to a 250-foot depth. You know, you would give yourself a certain amount of range. And when you got there, you dropped the appropriate torpedo on top of the target. That was it. Reverse the heading and then dial in the airspeed, and then the aircraft would fly back to the ship. That was it. Now, when the aircraft came back within visibility of the deck controller, the deck controller would assume command by switching on his transmitter, and then CIC would turn off theirs. And then the deck controller is the gentleman. He's got the stick. And he's going to bring this aircraft, and this is key, he's going to bring this aircraft in, landing on a very small pitching deck, and he's going to bring this aircraft in with rotors spinning at over 600 miles an hour, and you've got to be cool on doing this, because, again, you're going to be landing this, and we've seen aircraft, you know, they jump around a little bit when they land, but there were switches that were in the skids, so that when the aircraft made contact with the deck, it would immediately set the rotors to zero lift so that the aircraft would stay put. Once you touched down, it was over. It would dial all the lift out of the rotor system, and it would settle down. So, but you really had to be a great, great human to fly this unmanned system, because if you couldn't handle it, you know, you'd end up crashing the aircraft into the hangar, or you'd end up, you know, allowing it to skip across the deck and into the sea. I mean, these mishaps would occur with regularity, and that's what gave the QH-50, it gave it a bad name within the Navy, because they pointed their finger at the aircraft, and they felt that it was trouble prone and whatnot. But the reality was, is that we were also at the same time fighting an air war in Vietnam. The ages of the personnel that were operating our aircraft and maintaining it originally were supposed to be people that were in their mid-20s to 30s and have that kind of experience. The problem is that when we started looking at why we were losing our aircraft, we found that the average age of the personnel flying them were 18 and a half.
And oh, my God.
And so obviously...
So they were just allowed to drive cars, let alone an aircraft.
And so even though the drone helicopter was built to be flown by people with no aviation experience, you did need to have a certain amount of flight experience to be able to operate the drone. And the Navy just never got their arms around that problem. And when the Navy finally went to Secretary of Defense McNamara in 1966 and said, look, we need more money because just a little, I think they asked for $23 million. They said, we need to have better training facilities. We really need to get our arms around this problem in which even though we have surface personnel flying and aviation assets, they need to have better training. McNamara said, no, I'm not going to do this. You know, he felt that ASROC and the QH-50 were duplicate systems and that the ships with ASROC, which were predominantly Gearing-class destroyers, they didn't need to have QH-50s. So he was going to spread the QH-50s to other ships, and subsequently, of course, the flight crews all got broken up. Loss rates went up dramatically after that, and essentially it was just a stopgap measure just to give some of the destroyer escorts some capability. Some ships, like the Bronstein, had a fantastic time with it, but most other ships didn't. And so finally the Navy canceled in 1970, and by 1971, all QH-50s were ordered off ships. By January 71, they were ordered off all ship. And so, but, you know, what's key here is that even though the QH-50s didn't have as good as a sea-basing deployment as they could have, what happened when it left ship became an incredible miracle, because what happened is that when the aircraft went to Army use by the folks at White Sands Missile Range, or even by the Navy at China Lake in 1982, these activities used one common crew to fly the aircraft. And we saw something that was truly unique by the Army, because they had a common crew fly their aircraft for over 30 years straight at White Sands Missile Range, and they would use the aircraft to target tow. They would even allow the aircraft to be targets themselves for missile development and for new weapon intercept systems. And the Army, over that 30-year period, never lost a single aircraft that they did not intend to lose. And what's interesting is because they, and this is in spite of the fact that they had no training capability. There was no training left. All the training facilities had been closed. The Army had to self-train with the Navy documentation that they had at the time. And they had to do everything just at White Sands. They had no tender support. They had no part support other than what they could buy at Jarodyne. And we continued to part support them up through Jarodyne's closure in 1999.
So the control system is obviously a challenge. And I think, as in BJ's article, which to reiterate, is titled "Unmanned Naval Warfare: Retrospect and Prospect." You know, it's not only a C2 problem in the system itself, but it also seems to be a C2 problem in the institution that's trying to implement it. But people know about institutional failure. The fun thing is to learn about this system and all the kind of interesting stuff that history is kind of forgotten that occurred. And you kind of noted this, and if no one was paying attention, we're talking about a drone here that carries 2 torpedoes. That is a massive amount of weight, and that gives an incredible amount of flexibility. So you have this system that's designed to fight Soviet submarines for a fleet that is now going to war, whether it realizes it or not, in Vietnam. So let's move to that part of this story where you have this ASW drone. It's intended to drop nuclear weapons on top of Soviet submarines. And now all of a sudden guys are getting into the field in Southeast Asia, and they're starting to kind of to tinker with it. Different organizations, different ships, they're using them for different purposes. Let's talk about that for a little bit. So how did Dash evolve into the Vietnam War, and how did people use it?
Well, you know, the destroyers were also the Sumner Gearing class of destroyers that the Dash was operating from. During the FRAM program, they would lose one of their twin Mark 38 gun mounts, and so that left them with two left, one in the front and one in the back. And, I think they were still called Mount 51 and Mount 50, F-53. And so what was happening in Vietnam is that the ships were being called in to do naval gunfire support missions to support the Army or the Marines in country, because you could lob one of those 5-inch 38 shells some 9 miles, and the kill zone on one of those shells was close to 75 yards. And so bringing in that kind of artillery while the ship was safe out at sea was a big plus. Well, of course, the dash detachments on those ships had nothing to do. And so in many cases, the dash detachment belonged to ship's force, so they would be absorbed and used as gun crews or the like. Well, on the USS Blue, which was a Sumner-class destroyer, there was a Lieutenant Phil King, and what he came up with was, he said, you know, maybe we could do something different with these dash helicopters, because there's no submarines here. There's no reason that we should be even having them on our ship if we're not going to use them. So on a shore leave in Yokosuka, Japan, he went to the Navy Exchange and he bought some Sony TV cameras and some broadcast equipment. And he bought this at the Navy Exchange, went back to his ship, the Blue, and along with the electronic technicians, or the ETs, on the Blue, they installed the Sony TV cameras to essentially broadcast a live video feed back to his ship. And they even bought the it was a black and white TV display to be in the CIC. Well, when they went back on the gun line, they started flying their QH-50 up to 9 miles away, which was the range of the shells, which was within the range of the aircraft, and they were able to see barges. They were able to see sampans, which were being used for resupplying from the North Vietnamese into the South, into incursions. They were able to see all of this in real time, and they were able to then fire upon and score hits that way. Well, that got the attention of Admiral Combs, who was in charge of a command task unit down there, and he thought that this was a great thing that could be improved upon. And so, in short order, he got Jardine technical representatives out of Yokosuka to try to design what we called the Snoopy Sled. And Snoopy was the name of the program, and the term Snoopy doesn't mean, you know, Snoopy so much from the Peanuts cartoon character, but just pretty much that we were going to be snooping around. And Snoopy was, that term was used in a lot of different programs, but for us, it was a reconnaissance program. And so the tech rep started creating a Snoopy sled in Japan. They were asking Jardine for assistance, but Jardine was still busy building helicopters. And so a lot of this work was carried out by Captain Nelson Jackson, and he had just come off a ship rotation, and so he was in charge of the Snoopy detachment in Yokosuka, and they started popping out the Snoopy sleds for other gunline destroyers, and in short order, they came up with better innovations, because some of the guys, you know, like on the Glennon, those guys came up with the idea, well, you know, instead of just flying around with 1 hour of flight time, why don't we get some extra fuel tanks for the QH-50, and we'll just strap them on, and we can get up to 4 hours of flight time. And so that is what they did. So you had these innovators, essentially, on these small destroyers coming up with ideas for expanding the flight time, installing TV cameras, and also when you go out that far, you need better tracking. And so some of them were also installing different kinds of transponders so that they could get better radar tracking, because sometimes the aircraft would get so far out, sometimes they would just lose contact with them. And if a QH-50 loses contact, it goes into a no-wind hover until it runs out of fuel. And that was the way that the birds started getting lost at war doing reconnaissance missions, essentially at the same time when our Secretary of Defense McNamara was saying that the QH-50 was experiencing a high loss rate. So we're losing them in recon, but he is sitting in a congressional testimony complaining that that in their torpedo role, they're not functioning very well, which was, of course, just not true. But what are you going to do? So at any rate, ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, was watching all this and said to the Navy, look, you can't have all of these different ships coming up with their own different solutions to a common problem. We will take this and maybe we can make this into a better system. Well, around that time, Kaesan was occurring, and so the Military Air Command in Vietnam issued an urgent request because he wanted to have these reconnaissance-capable QH-50s and preferably armed. And so ARPA jumped on this. They created a small organizational group, and they got QH-50s directly from Gerardyne that they would then incorporate fuel tanks that could take 50 caliber or higher and be self-sealing. They would use Kohu all-weather cameras. They would use microwave associates to carry the beam or carry the information back to the ships. But you still had, you know, this was going to be a little bit of a lead time. So you still had ships like the De Haven out working the gun line, coming up with their own system for tracking their QH-50, which essentially involved an enlisted man with a rudimentary radar dish aiming it in the direction where they could get the best signal. That's what we called automatic tracking. And they would fly, and we have this on YouTube. We have it as a QH-50 Snoopy flight, and you can see a QH-50C model going out to Vietnam with the extra side tanks and the camera. And when it comes back, I think one of the antennas has been shot off. But, you know, you see this, and that is one of the rarest pieces of film footage that we still have to show that program. And so that's what all of these destroyer guys were doing in the very early days of 1965, 1967. By 1968, you've got Snoopy aircraft being deployed, and I don't know why, but they felt that painting them solid white made them invisible because these were going to fly at night. And so you had the USS Blue taking them into Da Nang, where they were going to be flown remotely from all the command and control equipment, miniaturized in a way, could be installed on a Jeep. And so they had these three, what we call ARPA birds, taken in to Vietnam and flown to assist in real kill missions. And of course, with a drone, you fly it until you lose it. And that's exactly what they did.
I mean, that's, you know, a much more dramatic example. The Roman Empire, which before its collapse had designed that entertainment device where that water was heated and it came out of the two pipes and it spun. And then you look at something like I said, like, man, if you guys weren't destroyed, that was the steam engine. And you look at a technology like this and you listen to the capabilities you're discussing, you say, like, what kind of world if someone had come in and said, you know what, this is the future. These automated, not automated at the time, but these remote systems, how can we automate them? And that the efforts that we really started in right just before 9/11 when they were starting to use drones to do some monitoring of terrorism and went into real earnest post 9/11, and you think, man, what if that had started in the 1960s? If someone really put the lever forward and said that these are technologies are the way that we're going to go, just, you know, different times, different timelines, like an episode of Fringe or Sliders, something like that, you know, primetime television. But this is so fascinating the way that you discuss innovation. And I think a lot of our listeners have read a number of articles and proceedings at SimSec, at War on the Rocks, about some of the difficulty and challenges with innovating today in the military. And you hear about a program like this, and you're like, wow, man, if only I had that level of flexibility. I mean, you describe many of the institutional challenges that we still face today and still have to overcome, but there is sort of an underlying sense of, I couldn't imagine today someone going out. I could, but the reaction to someone coming back with an off-the-shelf technology and just installing it on a ship system. I mean, that's a stroke of genius on that lieutenant's part.
Phil King, which is sort of interesting, he came back here to our dash shop about 2 years ago, and he brought members from the USS Blue, and they wanted to see the QH-50s, and it had been over 50 years, and we brought out the prettiest birds we had, and so that they could walk around them. But you know, it's stunning when you think back at everything that ARPA was doing. Just wasn't with reconnaissance. They were putting machine guns on QH-50s. They did that over at Pax River. That aircraft that's at the Pax River Museum actually survived, obviously, and it was the one that had the GAU-2B General Electric Gatling gun underneath it, and it was bore sighted to a Kohu camera. We also had them QH-50s with twin Mark 82 bombs, and it was to fly in behind the one QH-50 with the Gatling gun, so that the Gatling gun would clear the path, and then you had the QH-50 drop the two bombs. You know, this was really about platform multiplication and trying to really increase the platform capability, because you could get into a much shallower sea space, obviously, with a destroyer than you can with a carrier. You also don't want to bring your carrier anywhere near the fights, whereas a destroyer, you know, we just had so many of them, and in many ways, you know, when our destroyers did get hit, and when we did have a couple that did get shelled, and we did have a couple of personnel killed on those ships, you know, that can't be minimized. When you get that close to the battle, the enemy's going to fire back. And so, you know, here you had this drone helicopter, though, going out and sacrificing its life, and all you had to do is call up the supply officer and order another one. That was it. And that was, of course, the big plus for my father, because of the 800 total QH-50s that they built, plus the additional 200 aircraft worth of spare parts, the operators of the QH-50, not a single one was injured, and obviously not a single one was killed. But at the same time, though, the problem, and this is, you know, might strike some people as very odd, was that though we were constantly hitting our heads against the community of the manned aviation navy, and you know, they felt that resources were much just better spent. You know, for example, you know, the carrier boys did not want to be flying when a destroyer was flying its QH-50s around. And the only way that you get proficient is through practice. And this was even more critical for non-aviation types to fly the QH-50. But when a destroyer was providing plane guard for the carriers, the carrier commander would always order no QH-50 flying, no dash flights, because they're much less today. You hear about this today. You hear about this concern about drones and manned aircraft hitting each other in a contested airspace. It was the same way with the Navy. The aviation people did not want the QH-50s flying in their area. So when you had a Sumner Gearing destroyer off by itself doing naval gunfire support missions, no problem. They were doing their QH-50 reconnaissance work, and they flourished in that environment because they were allowed to. You know, in today's world, you know, we have the capability of having transponders, of having seek and avoid technology, and I think the manned aviation segment is running out of excuses. And so I don't know what the future will hold, other than by watching Amazon.com selling 1,000 DJI Phantom drones, you know, to the tune of 1,000 a week. And so, you know, the question is, you know, and you can sort of see, and you can see the resistance today of people saying, well, you know, one of these days we need to register all those drones. We need to put our arms around it. And of course, We QH-50 people, we only fly in military airspace or in airspace that is, you know, around a ship or at White Sands or at China Lake. But this idea that you're now going to, you know, go after these little guys that have the, you know, they're little toys, but still.
So if this is the equivalent of trying to tell me to register my cell phone because it's off the shelf.
Yeah.
It's easy to buy. I've got one in my desk drawer that my wife bought me for Christmas, and it's like, but you want me to register this? I mean, where does it begin and end? I mean, this, you know, we had another podcast about the definition of drone and what's the difference between a Tomahawk missile and a killer drone that just that comes back to you. You know, they're doing
right.
The same thing, except one isn't suicidal, and it's a definitional issue. So you have to now define something that is so ephemeral as to what exactly it is. You're like, oh, it's the quad rotor drone I see on TV. That's not where it ends. I mean, you have it absolutely right. I mean, it's still a pain in the butt. I mean, this is why they're building friggin' microwave guns and net throwers and all this other kind of stuff, because all kinds of are trying to fly their drone over nuclear power plants and the White House. But I mean, it's the equivalent of all the other sorts of popular technology we have today. Like, you look at ISIS and you look at other transnational, international terrorist organizations, and you see the Russians bombing the Syrians using cell phone GPS devices in their planes. These kinds of technologies are everywhere, and everyone, there's always a way for your opponent to use them. But we've sort of really punched through the ceiling of our time limit here, and I don't want to take more of your time. And of course, I have my wife tapping her foot, I'm sure, outside the door. But before we go, and again, I want to remind everyone that the story doesn't end here. We will have Peter back, and we will discuss this program, because it doesn't end here in Vietnam when the Navy kicks this program to the curb and McNamara says to take a hike. There is a future here. As he said, the last flight of the Dash was in 2006. So we're going to go and we're going to bring him back, and he's going to discuss the other ideas that were potentially thought about as implementable ideas for the Dash. But until then, Peter, we'll close out. If you want to take a minute or two, if there's a book you recommend reading, if there's a project, I know you work with a lot of museums. Maybe you have one that you would recommend some of our listeners that has a lot of the ordnance, because we didn't even get into that today. You do a lot of really hard work trying to preserve the history of military ordnance, the different kind of stuff that we use out in the field. So you do that service as well, and we'll get into that in the next podcast. But anything you want to talk about, you think our leaders or our listeners should know about, this is your sort of free-form minute or two to say whatever you wish.
I think what we have done in the last 17 years is really been trying to keep the Dash weapon system not to be forgotten. During those 17 years, we have acquired our aircraft, in some cases back. We've built up over 50 Mark 44 torpedoes so that you can see them around the United States in a armed up manner. We've got them again from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. We've got them at the New England Air Museum. You can Google these to find out where they are. We've got them all the way down, you know, at the, there's a museum even at the, oh Lord, I'm going to space out, over North Carolina. We've got one down there at the Douglas Airport at Charlotte. Of course, over at the Tucson-based Pima Air and Space Museum, the Airspace Museum in California, which is right outside Sacramento. We've tried to put aircraft and completion kits so that people can see not only the aircraft, but also the very simple command and control symbol that the drone controller had. We've tried to disperse that. We've made, of all the museums, the home of Dash is the destroyer museum ship, USS Joseph P. Kennedy, Jr., and in 8850, which is berthed at Fall River, Massachusetts, and part of the ship collection of Battleship Cove. If you go and see the QH-50s there, there are two of them, a D model and a C model. both in complete, the D model flies, but we don't fly it, of course. If you turned on the radios, it would take GPS offline for 100 square miles. But we have that on display there on the Kennedy so that you can see what the QH-50s were at sea, the small landing pad that the controller had. It is a completely refurbished and refitted suite, and we ask U.S. Naval personnel that are going to be planners to go and see how you can seabase a vertical takeoff and landing unmanned air vehicle. It doesn't need to be on a multi-trillion dollar ship platform. You know, the Kennedy is a 4,000-ton ship. That's it. It's built in World War II. I mean, these solutions to the problems of today aren't expensive. But, you know, if you learn from the past, you know, you can build upon it. And that's today's lesson.
Well, Peter, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you here today. I think there's a lot we can learn from this project, especially just the innovation involved. And I mean, really, I cannot give you enough kudos here for the history lesson that you've brought us. And for those, of course, who are interested in looking at BJ's piece that kind of inspired this investigation, it's Armed Forces Journal, Unmanned Naval Warfare, Retrospect and Prospect. And, of course, all of his 21st century books available from USNI Press that are on Amazon. So you should buy things for him or from him so that he can buy coffees with the dime or two that he gets from every book. I asked him, I told him, like, oh, man, they're out of books. That's great. Congratulations. And he says, I know. I can buy something from Starbucks now. I hope that's negative hyperbole. Again, Peter, thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again, and I know the audience looks forward to hearing from you.
Sure. Thank you. And, you know, if anyone has any questions, we do maintain a website on the DASH program. It's www.jardinehelicopters.com, and it'll tell you all the different models, and it'll tell you of the overall history and milestones if you have any questions, too.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.